Old in Court with Mike Trevelyan and Dean Sheridan. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Holding Court with me, Dean Sheridan, and my barrister friend, Michael Trevelyan. This is the podcast where we like to talk over court cases, crimes, crazy things from around the world, and get ourselves a little bit of legal advice off my learned friend, Michael, over here. And I just learn things and question it along the way, championing the common people. How are you, Mike?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Thank you. I was slightly shocked to see that you've had a bit of a shave. So I was concerned that I was looking at a sort of baby-faced Dean Sheridan. But it's growing back, I can tell. Not literally as I'm watching, but I can see that you're sort of growing it back again. So that's good. And yeah, generally, I'm pretty fine. I'm not so bad at all. How are things with you?
They're all good. It is a rainy day as we record, so part of the reason I was checking in, Mike, is to check if it is affecting your weather sensitivities.
Yes, I don't want to oversell the impact of weather on my mood. I'm not like a sort of mental health weather vane, but no, I'm doing all right. And this is, I think, the first recording that we have done since we became a three podcast with the addition of your pet kitten. Is that right?
Yes, I have a pet kitten now who is currently outside of the room because she cannot be trusted with wires or anything like that while I can't give her 100% attention. And the amount of times we would have to stop and start this recording would be never ending. So at the minute she's sort of just chilling on the bed, it seemed like a good time to sort of shut myself in here to the duration of this. But yeah, she's very, very cute. And she gets away with a lot because of it. She attacks like crazy. She slashed my legs in an attempt to, when falling off a table that she climbed up, to cling back on in sort of Hans Gruber style Die Hard fall. She decided to then cling on to the next lowest ledge, which was my leg, which is slashed all the way down. And when I go to stroke her, she thinks I'm playing and that I'm some sort of huge cat. In that case, she likes to bite and scratch the shit out of me as well. So it's all going well. Basically, they're not as noticeable, but when you put on any form of alcoholic cleaning gel, as we tend to do quite a lot these days, there's a fair deal of stinging involved.
Oh, yes, I can imagine that is unpleasant, to say the least. What would you say has been the cutest cat moment so far? What's really melted your heart?
She sleeps on my keyboard. While I'm working. So she looks, she's small at the minute, so she looks a bit like a desk ornament. So that's pretty good. There's loads of cute things. Like I find like her little hunting stuff pretty cute. Or when she like sort of goes up to a shoe, stops, and then hops over the shoe in like one bound, preparing herself for it, like she's hunting her prey, which I'm sure she will do in the future. I've seen there's a lot of pigeons in the garden, and I assume they will soon be coming to a sticky end.
Yes, well, I hope so, because pigeons are a national scourge.
I did think about shooting them. I have a little air rifle downstairs. But then I thought to myself, as we're in quite close proximity in the new house to families with children, how they would take it to if they by chance happened to be looking out the window or in their gardens at the time, when they see it on top of an adjoining fence, the demise of a pigeon.
And I suppose you've not lived there very long, and it's very easy to quickly garner a reputation as the crazy couple that shoots at pigeons.
Yeah, I don't want to come out and see red paint on my door that says pigeon killer, you know.
Exactly.
I'm 90% sure it would be one of the two neighbours that would have painted that, because who else would have seen me shoot the pigeon? But it might have got around the close pretty quick, and you don't want that.
No, exactly. Although I have a degree of sympathy for pigeons in recent weeks, because I found out, and I don't think I've said this on the podcast before, but forgive me if I have, the reason why pigeons are so prevalent in this country is because they used to be kept domestically. And then everyone just decided that they weren't interested in pigeons anymore. So they just kind of let them all go free. And that's why we have so many now feral pigeons.
Well, they were like house pets, a bit like...
But they were kept like food, like... so you would farm them, apparently.
Oh, and for food? Everyone... You'd eat a grey pigeon, as in like one that goes around town, eats all the shit off the floor, a flying rat.
Well, I mean, I don't know if they've sort of they've become more feral as a result of no longer having English farmers kind of looking after them. But yeah, effectively, I don't know if it's like a different kind of breed type situation, if they've kind of evolved.
I'm just thinking, like, you go back in time and there's a pigeon in a top hat, like,
exactly
in the 1800s.
Yes, exactly. So I'm not entirely sure of the whole history behind it, but yeah, apparently we used to sort of farm them and then we just kind of all got bored of that and just released them.
Well, how long ago was this? Do you know what sort of, like,
in era? My mind, I'm thinking of like the 1800s, but I don't think I was told that. I think it just sounds about the
right.
Well,
the only reason I think of the 1800s, and it might just be one of those historical inaccuracies when it comes to like filming a TV show or something like that, but there's always like, you know, like they run through a street in Les Mis or something and disperse a bunch of pigeons. Whereas if they were, you know, guests, I was about to say, if they were pets at the time, then it wouldn't be too bad.
No, that's true. I mean, on reflection, this may be one of those things where I've been told something that's not true. And now I've repeated it. Here we are, dear listener. I will look into this pigeon situation. And next week, Dean, you can look forward to my pigeon report.
Well, there we go. So make sure you tune in next week for Mike's first edition of Pigeon Report, which we could make a regular thing each week. So what I'll do is I will start with our first case, which is, and let me just get it ready, and then I make sure I get the correct tab up so we can talk about this. This is a WPC who claimed 1.5 million after being hit by a pineapple, but gets just £3,000 in compensation. So this is a lady, Tracy Ormsby, I don't know, maybe you've heard this, who basically got hit by a pineapple in the middle of, I think it was like a protest or something like that that she went to, and someone launched a pineapple at her. And I know it kind of seems, you know, Jesus, I wouldn't want to be hit by a pineapple. It must have really hurt. Well, she was actually hit in the chest by the pineapple as well. So I'm guessing if she's a police officer, she's bound to be wearing some sort of stab-proof vest or uniform.
But was it pineapple-proof? That's the question.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Criminals are getting smart these days, because they started by just trying to stab a local law enforcement, shoot them occasionally. When they realized that wasn't working, they turned to the fruit stands to try and find ways of warfare against them. So yes, she was hit by a pineapple, but she was hit in the chest. She wasn't hit in the face. So a former policewoman who claimed 1.5 million damages for being hit by a pineapple was awarded just £3,000 yesterday. A judge branded Constable Tracy Ormsby, 37, a liar who consistently misled medical experts. So it seems that when she was diagnosed as suffering post-traumatic stress disorder from the pineapple-based incident, her ex said, she actually used the words, ka-ching, I'm in the money, when this happened. She was seeing a married policeman and used to blackmail him to lie for her in court, saying she would show his wife incriminating photographs if he didn't. And this is the guy who turned around and said that she had said ka-ching. Despite claiming to have been left a mentally scarred recluse by her injury, which happened when it was a demonstration, turned into a riot. So the only injury she got in the middle of a riot was a pineapple. She's had holidays in Australia, France, Crete, Spain and Gran Canaria. So in a written judgment at the Court of Session yesterday, Lord Malcolm said the overall picture is clouded and complicated by her willingness to be untruthful and conceal material facts in order to further her interests. So he says, I consider at best there is very, very considerable degree of exaggeration in her account of her disabilities. So she got slightly hurt by the pineapple that was hurled at her at a protest at the closure of Glasgow's Govanhill Baths in 2001. She didn't actually leave the force in Strathclyde until 2004. And then she sued them, claiming that Chief Constable had botched the operation. She was exposed to unnecessary and unacceptable risk, such as pineapple throwing, and left her mentally scarred for life, forced her to quit her job. Again, we come back to the thing when we talk about jobs and the things that they entail, like the fireman who's afraid of fire, or things you might see that might affect you. And it seems like, as we just said, she went into this job knowing that there could possibly be dangerous situations, including knives, guns, etc., any form of weapon. But when it came down to the pineapple, it was just that step too far.
Yeah, this raises a couple of interesting points. First of all, going back to, I think, the last but one podcast, why do we not have armadillo-based body armor? Because a pineapple would have just bounced straight off that. That would have been absolutely fine. But more substantially, from a legal point of view, there are a number of things with this. Firstly, of course, this is a Scottish case. You mentioned the Court of Session, which is the Scottish kind of court system. So it wouldn't have been applying the same law that we have here. But a couple of things that are quite interesting is that, firstly, damages for personal injury in England and Wales are rather better defined nowadays than they were in decades past. So I would be surprised, without looking it up, if there was any prospect of somebody having post-traumatic stress disorder, even to what she claimed, which sounds like a fairly significant degree, and realistically being in a position to claim $1.5 million?
That's what she wanted, yeah.
$1.5 million, which seems to me to be far too much anyway. But of course, the other element to all of this is that she was a big liar, liar, pants on fire. And this raises quite an interesting thing procedurally about how the court is dealing with personal injury claims, of which this would have been one, where the claimant is a liar. And to take you back a few years, Dean, if you were to
issue a claim... Can I just do the time travel theme in there? No, what? No, that's the Twilight Zone.
That's the Twilight Zone.
What did they used to do in Wayne's World?
Oh, no, that's... No. I was doing Doctor Who then.
Oh, I thought you were doing Knight Rider. Anyway... So the failed section where I did the time travel, let's just imagine we've gone back in time.
So it's some time in the past, quite a few years ago, I think probably around 2010 or something like that. And if you issued a claim for personal injury, it used to be the case, or now that we're in 2010, it is the case, that your solicitors who are helping you with the claim, and any barrister that gets involved, can charge a success fee on top of their legal costs. So the solicitors will incur a load of costs. Your claim will be successful, hopefully, and the solicitors will charge a success fee, which can be up to 100% of their normal legal costs, and the barrister can do the same. The idea was that this was a way of encouraging people who couldn't pay for legal advice and legal representation, because it allowed solicitors and barristers to take cases on a no-win, no-fee basis, otherwise known as conditional fee. Because the idea was that although if you lost, from the lawyer's perspective, you wouldn't get paid, you could afford to take on more cases, because on those cases where you did win, you would recover a success fee, and that would effectively balance out the cases where you lost. Mm-hmm. The problem was, from defendants' point of view, they started complaining quite a lot about this, and in individual cases were saying, well, why should we pay twice as much costs to you just to cover you for those cases you've taken in other circumstances where you've lost them? We're ending up with massive cost bills. This isn't fair. So the view was taken that they were going to outlaw these sorts of success fee arrangements. So solicitors and barristers can still do cases on a no-win, no-fee, but they're not allowed to charge a success fee. So the incentive to take on those cases has been completely undercut. The compromise, giving with one hand, taking with the other, was that they were going to introduce a thing which was called qualified one-way cost shifting, or QOCS.
It's a fancy name.
It is a fancy name, and it's quite a complicated thing. But the fundamental aspect of QOCS is that if you nowadays are a claimant and you're issuing a claim for personal injury, you can't charge a success fee, or your solicitors can't charge you a success fee. But if you bring your claim and you lose, the defendant isn't allowed to get a costs order against you, or more accurately, is allowed to get a costs order against you, but isn't allowed to enforce the costs order without the permission of the court. So they can get a cost order, but it's effectively useless. There are exceptions to qualified one-way cost shifting. One of those is where the claimant has been found to have been fundamentally dishonest in the claim. And if you're found to be fundamentally dishonest, you lose the protection of qualified one-way cost shifting. And the defendant, who's then been successful in defeating your claim, can claim all of their costs from you. So if you are a liar, liar, pants on fire, you run a considerable risk of paying costs. And this woman clearly was. I am not surprised, because it's a Scottish case and the system is different, to hear that she was able to still recover some damages. What did you say, £3,000?
Yeah, well, he said he awarded her £3,000 for the only physical consequence of the riot, a minor chest injury. So she basically got awarded with slight injury from the pineapple. And the judge said he believed that was because it would run counter to the picture. She's on about the way that she acted there, sorry, underneath. Because then on top of that, he was on about how she was acting when she was cross-examined. He says, I cannot reconcile the person I saw in cross-examination with the fearful and fragile person described in some of the medical reports. Because during cross-examination, she dealt confidently with vigorous and robust questioning, and she fought her corner with tenacity. So, like, she put a great description of supposedly how she felt, given that she had, you know, been on holidays to Australia, France, Crete, Spain, and Gran Canaria. She put something like she had become violent, smashed up her flat, and was like a caged lion living Ooh. In a dark and isolated world.
Wow. Okay. So, what would happen in this jurisdiction is that the defendant would apply to the court at the conclusion of the trial, having heard the judge's findings that she was dishonest. And the judge would apply, the defendant would apply to the judge, refer them to section 57 of the Criminal Justice and Courts Act of 2015. And what that says is that if you've made a claim for damages for personal injury, and the court finds that you are entitled to damages in respect of that claim. So just like this Scottish judge saying you'll get your few thousand pounds because you have got some physical injury. But the court's satisfied on the balance of probabilities that the claimant has been fundamentally dishonest. Not only does the court have to dismiss your claim, but you also have to have recorded in the order the amount of damages that you would have got had it not have been dismissed. So what would happen to this lady in England and Wales is the judge would say, I'm assessing your damages for your personal injury at £3,000, but I found you to be dishonest, so you don't get your £3,000. That's what you could have won, but you don't, and you get nothing. And in fact, you have to pay all of the defendant's costs as well. So there's now a considerable penalty for being found to be dishonest.
Well, you know, there's a level. So she's suing a police force, and it obviously mentions that she's blackmailing a married police officer. Mm. I mean, is that not slightly criminal? What's blackmail? What are the sort of blackmail rules and regulations?
Oh yeah, I mean, blackmail's a crime.
So she's blackmailing for him to lie in court to get the money. Is what yes. it says here. So I would imagine, I mean, there's nothing more about anything happening. She gets a 3,000 and that's it. But I'm surprised that nothing more was done about that.
Yes, I mean, I suppose we wouldn't necessarily know, because it might be the sort of thing where once the judgment had been disseminated, then some investigations were undertaken and some action taken that wasn't subsequently reported. But yes, on the face of it, if there's been a finding that one of the witnesses has been blackmailed, then you would expect that to be taken further.
So what level of fruit would it take to make you quit your job, Mike?
Being thrown at me specifically.
Yeah, but not like you've walked into the office, there's a fruit salad on your table, and you're like, you know what? This is about where I, it's about all I can deal with right now.
That's a straw that breaks the camel's back.
Hang the wig up on the wall and leave.
What would it take? I think I'd probably be looking at a watermelon, because yeah, that's a pretty substantial piece of fruit.
What's the one? Watermelon is like green and black, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. What's the one that is it just a regular melon that looks about the same, but it looks like a bit like webby? I don't eat fruit.
Oh, I love yellow veg. One.
I love veg, honeydew. But I don't eat. Is that what it is? It's like got like a like a webby exterior? Is it like white?
Because there's the honeydew that's yellow and it sometimes has like white veins on it.
Yeah, I think that's it.
And then there's a much smaller one that's like green with like a white, much more of like a white web around. And that's a cantaloupe, I think.
I think so. I don't, like I say, I'm not a fruit fan. I'll eat any veg going, but not fruit. So I don't really know what afoma. I know what a dragon fruit is. And actually that would be something that would make me probably sue.
Yeah, that's pretty spiky, isn't it? The dragon fruit.
Yeah, it's like literally like, yeah, like throwing a hefty pine cone at someone.
Yes. Yes. And you wouldn't want that. You wouldn't want that. So I think what you're talking about is a honeydew melon. And what I will say is that, do you know the Muppets characters with Beaker, the sort of failed science assistant?
Yeah.
The scientist Muppet to which Beaker is the assistant, yeah, his actual name is Dr. Bunsen Honeydew. And that name just makes me laugh every time because he has a face like a honeydew melon.
Like a honeydew. Yeah. And Beaker looks a bit like a carrot.
Yes, absolutely, he does.
I think so.
And I thoroughly enjoy watching Beaker and Dr. Bunsen Honeydew get into mischief. It's great fun.
To be fair, the only things I've ever seen Muppets-wise, really, was just the movies, the musical sort of Treasure Island and the classic Christmas Carol. And all I know about Beaker is that he goes, meep, 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 meep. That's about it.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I've never actually watched a whole Muppets movie all the way through.
I think you've just lost us about half of our audience.
Yeah, it's disappointing, isn't it? I've just never sort of been able to sit through a whole one. But
it's just too much for you to take. So maybe I overstepped when I said how, you know, what level of fruit. It's like, what kind of Muppets film would make you leave your career? You're like, everyone's got a Muppets film on in chambers. You're like, no, I just can't make it to the end of it.
Well, I find it very difficult to watch films because it's such an investment of time. I think it's really weird to be like, I'm going to spend, you know, 2.5 hours now sitting and watching this film, which might turn out to be rubbish. But then I say that on a day that you and I are about to go to the pub and watch an England game that almost certainly will be rubbish.
Yeah, I'm not a big football fan, but the sort of pub environment and the fact that it's Euros is one of the main reasons that I am interested in this.
Yes, that is fair.
Yeah, I do feel like the odd one out not liking football, or in America, soccer. But it's football, because the truth is, one is played with your feet and one you hold the ball. So
yes, well, that's exactly right. And that is why football will always be football and American football will always be a fairly rubbish game.
Mike, we're trying to grow our audience here. You can't just keep throwing stuff like that out.
Well, dear listener, if you are a fan of American football and you are minded to even the tiniest degree to stop listening to this show because I just criticized American football, email the show and I will express a profound apology for what I've just said. But I don't think anyone sensible listening to this podcast will be a fan of American football in the first place.
Okay. So we'll leave the... Oh, my God. The cat has managed to open the door.
I can see it behind you. The door's just sort of creaking open. How's he done that?
I don't know. Wow.
So
I don't know whether to be annoyed or impressed.
I would be both.
Hello. Anyway, I will... I'll continue. So,
is it possible to sort of hold your cat up to the microphone and see if we can get a little bit of purring action? Is it making any noise?
I wouldn't, because I believe it would be teaching her that it is okay to eat my wires, which she seems to think all right. At the minute, she's obsessed with a bag of shoes. So, and they're not my shoes, so I'm all right with that. So anyway, we will move on to our next case. Have you heard the name Jonathan Lee Riches?
No.
Okay. So Jonathan Lee Riches was a prisoner, or is a prisoner. I don't know if he is. I think he might be free now. But he has filed over 2,600 lawsuits whilst in federal custody. Okay, including a lawsuit that, just ridiculous lawsuits for no reason. Obviously, he's bored. Well, most of them have been dismissed. But for instance, take this one. This is one I've looked up. I don't even know what he's raising it for. It's a nature of suit. Prisoner, civil rights, U.S. defendant. That's the nature. And the case type is civil, based in Philadelphia. There are a lot of defendants, right? The, the custodian is MC Hammer, just to start off, right? So I'm just going to sort of go down a little and reveal just a few of the defendants. One is Paula Abdul. There's Adolf Hitler's National Socialist Party. Jessica Alba, American Express Credit Card Corporation. Baptist Church, Barclays. What else we got down here? Joseph Biden. He's on here somewhere. And this is just going, let's go even further down. There's so many. It goes alphabetically. The Planet of Pluto. Plato. Plymouth Rock. Margaret Thatcher. Salvation Army. The Kremlin. And let's see if we can get any of these bottom ones. Justin Timberlake, Toll Brothers, Trojan Horse, Donald Trump. All the presidents are on there. Oh. Tsunami victims are a defendant on here, as well as Tina Turner, Mike Tyson, and the United Methodist Church. I mean, there's a lot. And I don't even know what it's for. So this was thrown out, but this is just one. I mean, the United States Holocaust Museum is a defendant on here as well.
Right.
So, Zeus, he's another defendant. So, basically, Richard filed for an injunction then later on against the Guinness Book of World Records, because the Guinness Book of World Records were going to have him in there as the most litigious man. So, so he sued them for it. So, yes, the vast majority of Richard's filings were dismissed. And I believe he has just had a case brought against him for wasting judicial time by raising all of these false allegations. I think it was in July 2018, Richards was indicted by a federal grand jury in Arizona. He is charged with making false statements and other frauds after an attempt to file a lawsuit against Gabby Giffords while posing as Jared Lee Loeffner. I don't know who that is. But yes, most of them have been dismissed and he's had a case brought against him. He's just a crazy person that is in prison that likes to sue anything he can get his hands on. I mean, here's another one that goes along with our video games. On April 9, 2008, Richard filed a request for a temporary restraining order in the US District Court against Grand Theft Auto publisher Take-Two, developer Rockstar Games, FCI Williamsburg, and Grand Theft Auto itself, claiming that the defendants put me in prison, the inmate stated. Defendants contributed to plaintiff committing identity theft. Defendants' games show sex, drugs, and violence, which offends me, Richards continued. Defendants put me in prison. I face imminent danger from violent inmates who played Grand Theft Auto, who will knock me out and take my gold Jesus cross. That's a quote from him there. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, we've just talked about the lawyers and the amount of money that it can cost. So what are the chances that on this extreme other level, where at least this woman got 3,000 before and was lying and at least basing it on some sort of truth, that this guy is actually just raising 2,600 cases? He is also, just to let you know, a former American lawyer. A convicted fraudster. So, and he's filed most of them under various state district court. What are your thoughts?
Well, this sort of thing, not to anything like this degree, but does happen occasionally in this jurisdiction. You'll come across litigants who are vexatious and persistent litigants, and either in the context of a claim, they will just persist in making unmeritorious applications. Or indeed, like this chap, they will just issue claims left, right and centre and start fresh proceedings all the time. There is a mechanism for dealing with people who act in that way. And the way of dealing with it is to obtain what's known as a civil restraining order, which is an order that prevents them, either generally or specifically, from issuing fresh applications or bringing fresh claims without the permission of a judge. So if you have somebody who, like this chap, keeps issuing fresh claims at court, then if they are struck out as being without merit and marked as being without merit, I think after you've had two without merit applications or without merit claims struck out, the judge can make a civil restraint order. And that's effectively a direction to the court staff that you are not to issue any further claims from this person without referring the claim to a judge first.
So do you think that's why he's going to all these different areas and doing them all over the place?
Yeah, I mean, if there's a similar system, and I imagine that there is in the States, but it will be, I assume, state by state rather than across the entire country. So yes, that would seem to be a plausible reason as to why he would be issuing his claims in lots of different places to try and get around the state laws, and presumably might also be why he's using aliases so that they don't necessarily connect a new claim to one of the previous ones that he's made. But yeah, it does happen, and it's very odd when it does, because if nothing else, it's a waste of money, particularly, you know, in the civil jurisdiction here. You issue a claim, it's struck out as being completely without merit, and then inevitably you end up having to pay some costs. So it's not the sort of thing to do very often as a hobby, even if you're bored, as this chap apparently is.
Well, he's in prison, so I think he's just having a go. I don't even know if he truly believes they're ever going to take any form of flight. For instance, this one doesn't even make any sense. He sued the late Benazir Bhutto, Pervez Musharraf, and the Immigration and Naturalization Service on November 7, 2007, to prevent himself from being deported to Pakistan and tortured upon his release from prison in March 2012. There is no evidence beyond this lawsuit of any attempt to deport Riches. So it's just kind of like, it's like, oh, just in case they're planning on sending me to Pakistan for torture, I'm going to start this lawsuit.
Yeah, that's slightly odd. And it raises, actually, it connects in my mind to something that I see not infrequently in the immigration tribunal, where I deal with clients who are seeking asylum and they're trying to avoid being returned to their country of origin. And one of the things which some clients will do, if their claim for asylum is completely bogus, what they might do is engage in the UK in what's called surplus activities, which is activities here that might bolster their claim for asylum. So what they will be saying is, I can't go back to, for example, Pakistan because the government are going to get me. If I do, because the government don't like me, they're going to torture me or whatever it might be, because they think I am a political activist. And sometimes what you will see is people will engage in political activity here, by primarily often by way of social media, posting anti-regime messages and things like that. Oh, so okay. If they're from somewhere like Iran, and they will then use that and say, well, this is part of my political activity. And if the Iranian regime, for example, see these social media posts condemning the regime, then on return to Iran, I will be tortured and therefore I am a refugee.
So they'll purposely put their own life at risk in an attempt to not go back.
Yes, exactly. They will post things that they know will potentially be very damaging in the hope that it will be sufficient to make out their claim for asylum. But as you indicate, there's quite a big risk there, because if your claim for asylum doesn't succeed, it's unlikely that the authorities in their home country are going to take into account the fact that the anti-regime posts were not necessarily genuine.
He was just like, I was just joking. It was just
exactly.
God, that's quite a risk. You must really not want to go back to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you sometimes also see people who will protest outside the national embassies in London and that sort of thing, effectively in the hope of being seen by the embassy staff and being able to then make a connection between their protesting and some governmental disapproval of what they've done.
I just find it crazy that this guy is an ex-lawyer and managed to do it, but he hasn't thought of like even a smart way of making at least a little bit of money.
Yes, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? Because, you know, just like doctors tend to make the worst patients, I think lawyers tend to make the worst litigants, because they know enough about the system to gum it up if they want to. And I suppose it depends on the circumstances, doesn't it, as to why he's now a former lawyer, what exactly happened to him. I've met a few people, for example, who used to be barristers who, you know, had some, you know, mental health problems and things, and they then present as vexatious litigants. But it's just because they've had some unfortunate turns in their life. This guy, I think he said, was convicted of fraud, so I've got slightly less sympathy for him than those.
So if you were to try your luck at a particularly crazy attempt at, like this man, what would you choose? What would your crazy litigation be?
I think I would probably try to get, this isn't strictly litigation, but I would try to get some sort of inquest started about somebody's death. in the course of which I would implicate the Queen in the death. Because it's a little known fact that although you can't sue the Queen, because the courts are obviously in Her Majesty's name, coroners have the power to compel anyone to attend before them for the purposes of an inquest. And although a member of the royal family, to my knowledge, has never been compelled by a coroner to attend an inquest, in theory, you could get an order compelling the Queen to attend and be be questioned on this theory that I had concocted, that she was somehow engaged in the unfortunate demise of whoever the subject of the inquest was. So that would be my crazy crackpot idea.
And who would that person be? Who are you waiting to die to do it? That it would more likely be have to go ahead. I mean, surely they could just throw it out if it seems too ridiculous. So you have to have something that might line in a little bit. And don't say Meghan Markle.
No, what I might do is I might sort of go the other way with it. And rather than pick somebody that has a degree of notoriety, wait until, for example, the Queen is at Windsor Castle or something. Kill somebody who lives in Windsor and then just leave a series of very obvious clues to the fact that it was the Queen. So sort of leave a sort of tiara on the nightstand, maybe have a sort of long ermine robe left there as well, and things like that, just to give the impression that it was all done by the Queen on a sort of jolly jape.
This kind of, if you were going to have fun and raise a fun litigation case, has actually turned into you committing a murder for the banter of the Queen having to be called to an inquest. You know, that was good. Meanwhile, some
true.
Poor bloke's dead. You've also got to somehow break into Windsor Castle.
Well, no, because I suppose, on reflection, I'm not sure this would work.
Well, I'm glad we spoke about it on the podcast first. saved you actually going out and attempting it and then failing there, because that would have been awkward.
Yeah, because you don't want to be halfway through and then going, oh, wait a minute, this isn't going to work.
Yeah, like the guy's dead, but I haven't got a tiara.
Exactly, and then before you know it, you're off to Home Bargains, picking up a cheap princess costume and just scattering the bits around the room.
Yeah, I'd love like someone mistook that for the Queen's jewellery. It's like, oh, it's the Queen's Home Bargain tiara. She's left it.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Because there's a theory that Jack the Ripper was either a member of the royal family or a member of the aristocracy, wasn't there?
Yeah, he was like a surgeon. I think, I forget what the name of it was, or he was meant to be some famous surgeon. That's why he was able to do the things he was able to do, like chop them up. Wow.
Oh, okay.
Chop them up well. Okay. That wasn't great speak, was it? Chop them up well.
You do the speak for the podcast.
Yeah. It was meant to, because it was like organs and stuff were like surgically removed by Jack the Ripper. And it was obviously quite a bit of a skill in those days to be able to do that.
Oh, fair enough. I didn't realise that actually.
You just don't look up enough about Jack the Ripper.
I do not. There's plenty for me to read up about.
You don't watch films, but you've not reading up on Jack the Ripper. So
no,
next week,
on my list,
I will present Mike with the case of Jack the Ripper.
And it's one of the only cases you've ever presented to me where I can confidently say, yes, I have heard of this.
Obviously, he was never caught, was he?
No. Yeah.
So
I suppose we could do our own murder mystery and try and uncover the true identity of Jack the Ripper.
Are we going to create one of those podcasts where people with absolutely no knowledge of detective work sit down and try and solve crimes that no actual government agency has been able to, but via podcast and the power of the people will finally uncover who Jack the Ripper was?
Well, this is the thing, you see, because is it that the government agencies have not been able to uncover it, or is it all a massive conspiracy that goes straight to the heart of government?
See, this is how we increase our listenership. We dive into conspiracy and murder mystery, and we're already up there in the millions. And then we'll have like the shock at the end of the episode where I've actually discovered Jack the Ripper's secret Instagram account.
Yeah, and all we've got to do is connect it all back to Big Parrot, and then all the clues are there, aren't they?
I've got a loop. And then before you know it, we're getting phone calls. Netflix, they want us for a six-part dramatization of the Jack the Ripper Parrot conspiracy.
Exactly. Get in touch, Netflix, get in touch.
So, away from that, and now on to something crazy. This is I Call Bullshit for this week. Okay, you ready for this, Mike?
I feel like I am.
Let me just explain to anyone who's tuned in for the first episode. I Call Bullshit is a part of the show where I present Mike with a crime or a court case that seems too good to be true or too crazy to be true. And most of the time, sometimes it is, but then sometimes it's not. So I have to present it to Mike and he has to claim if it's bullshit or not. So I just give you the headline. It is FBI seizes over 3,000 penises during raid at morgue employee's home.
Oh, dear. I think this is going to be true, but I desperately want it to be bullshit.
This is bullshit.
Oh, good. Thank God, because that was going to be most unpleasant.
But it was shared a lot. Like, it was one of the most shared fake news things in 2017, I believe it was. Okay. Yeah, September 2017, it says here that I could read. But yeah, it was a massively shared fake. But it says FBI agents made an astonishing discovery this morning while executing a search warrant at the residence of Houston mortician. 3,178 embalmed human penises. The Federal Bureau of Investigation suspected 50-year-old Dave Murray. See, this is what I like, these ones, the ones with names. And there's a picture, and I will show it to you. An employee of the Harris County Morgue of being implicated in an organ trafficking network. Organ trafficking penises. I mean, can you? Oh, can you have penis transplant?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident you can. I don't know why I said that initially as if I was.
Yeah, I know, you said it
confident.
So sure then. You're like, yeah. I'll give you the number of my guy.
He's good, you'd never know. Yeah. But I'm pretty confident you can. But I suppose I don't know if it's one of those things where you can have a transplant or you can have it reattached. If it's been cut off.
I know you can get an extension, can't you? But that's like plastic surgery. That's like working with
what's
already
there. Yeah, I mean, certainly the number
of
spam emails I get telling me that you can lead me to believe that it's definitely a thing. But yeah, there was a woman, wasn't there, who cut off her, I think, husband or boyfriend's penis.
Yes.
And then it had to be sort of surgically reattached. So that's definitely a thing.
Well, that was another fake news thing, one of the ones I was going to go with. But then I saw this. It was another one that was shared a lot, which is a woman cut off boyfriend's penis for not looking her in the eyes during sex.
Oh,
that was fake as well. But I know the story you're on about. Isn't that the one where the Bee Gees sang a song about the guy's penis?
The only Bee Gees song I know is Staying Alive.
I don't think it was a hit. I have to look this up. So this guy, was it like the 90s? Or was it like the late 80s? Did she chop up his knob and throw it out a window of the car? And then they managed to pick it up and then... Oh, and for international listeners, knob is slang for penis. Let's have a look. Bee Gees, penis song. I'm really scared what I'm going to find here.
Yeah, this seems like the kind of thing not to be randomly Googling, but
Bee Gees penis skin, penis song. Bee Gees once performed a parody of their hit song as tribute to John Bobbitt. Yeah, penis. To love somebody, they changed to lose your penis. And they did it as a parody for John Bobbitt, who was the guy who actually had his penis cut off. So this fake story of the woman who cut it off, I think the joke is more the reason why she did it, which is because he wouldn't look her in the eyes during sex, is actually not that crazy a thing to believe, because I know for a fact that John Bobbitt had his penis cut off and then managed to get it sewn back on. But yeah, this fake guy Dave Murray investigated several reports of missing organs and body parts. Dozens of agents raided his residence this morning, hoping to find evidence of his involvement in the crimes. What they found on the site was a lot more disturbing than what they expected, as the FBI spokeswoman Andy Ramirez described the scene in an interview with WNTV4. There were shelves everywhere filled with hundreds of glass jars, each of them contained a penis floating in formalin. But this isn't that crazy, because it's actually quite similar, apart from the amount of penises involved, to to our story that we were following of the morgue and funeral home that was selling people's bodies, complete bodies and organs.
Oh, yes, of course. That's right. That was a bit of a racket going on, wasn't it?
Yeah, so this seems like that. Like, it's kind of believable. It's just a specific need for penises that takes it to the edge. You know, if I was like, they came in and found loads of embalmed body parts, well, it seemed like a serial killer, but obviously they're already dead. Then you think he's got it, but why would you have over 3,000 penises? I mean, I don't know how that market works, or I'm pretty sure like losing a finger, you know, you lose a finger, you get it sewed back on, it works. I'm pretty sure it's the amount of time between losing an extremity and it being sewn back on or put back on is how much of it you will save. So I imagine if he's got 3,000 penises, first of all, that would take some time. It'd have to have 3,000 bodies through in and out and mail. He would then have to have chopped all their dicks off and then put them in their jars. And they must be selling at a pretty slow rate. I'm pretty sure, you know, what are the chances that they'll be in working order by the time he gets to, say, the sale of the 3,000th penis?
Well, yeah, I mean, there can't be that much of a market for old penises, can there? Well, because, what would you do with them?
There's a quote, he said, he explained in great detail how he had been cutting off dead men's genital organs and collecting them for more than 10 years. So he's actually just collecting them.
Yeah, oh, it was just, so a bit of a hobby.
Just a hobby. Maybe he sold the organs, kept the penises for himself.
Sort of a nobby, if you will.
Nobby's nuts.
yes, I mean, there can't be... No. I mean, this is bullshit anyway, but even if part of it were true, I could not imagine somebody wanting to collect penises. I could understand it if you were a sort of particularly weird woman, or I suppose gay person who wanted to sort of take the penis of your lovers as a trophy. But just generally collecting penises, I find to be an odd habit.
That would, how many would you get through?
I mean, I personally get
No. I mean, like, you're just like, I understand if you're a woman or a gay person who enjoyed penises and you just want to take them from your ex-lovers. I mean, like,
yeah.
But you surely should have had to kill all of her ex-lovers. It's not something that just goes under the radar, is it?
Well, no. I mean, I'm not suggesting it would be commonplace or advisable, but I can imagine that, you know, somebody who's slightly unhinged would do something like that.
What would you do if someone came up to you and said, would you be the defendant for this guy? What's he done? He's he collected 3,156 penises.
I'd say, I am in. No, I'd say, what's the fee? Then I would say, I'm probably in.
I'm probably in. Well, yes. How do you reckon you could defend it? Just give me an idea. Let's say you're off the cuff and you're like, what could I use? What, use your broad legal knowledge to say how I would stop the penis collector from going to prison.
Insanity?
Well, yeah, actually, that pretty would strike good,
me as a pretty useful thing to look into.
I mean, because what would it count as? Because if he owned it, it was a morgue, wasn't it? So they're all dead. He didn't kill anyone.
No, but there are specific crimes to do with sort of interfering with corpses and things. So I think it would probably be something like that. I think there's a crime for is it mutilating corpses or disturbing corpses or something?
Okay, yeah, I guess that would have been for like grave diggers, etc.
Yes, I mean, I suppose it's probably not necessarily designed to capture the penis enthusiast who just happens to have a large collection. But yeah, I imagine it would be something like that.
I will, just before we end today, it's best to show you, gentlemen,
I thought you were going to say, show you our genitalia.
Then. No. I mean, I know we don't record this visually, but...
I mean, this guy... Yes. I mean, he looks like the kind of guy that would have over 3,000 penises in his home. He's got a very odd hairstyle, because it's actually not an unattractive hairstyle for a woman. It's a sort of like a sort of bushy topknotty thing. And
He looks like a monarch.
Well, I don't know. I'm not I mean, I'm not a hairstylist. I don't really know. But I think it's quite a nice hairstyle. What do you think?
Not at all, Mike. But I know. I know what you look for in the ladies, and I will keep an eye out. Should I see any female that looks like this genital collector, I will send you away. But now you'll always have it in your mind. If anyone did turn up with this haircut, you'd like be like, they'd be like, oh, do you want to go to bed? And you're like, well, actually, maybe not. Just like hold,
yeah,
up yourself and walk away.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. I'm interested in this because are all of these stories fake? Are these all fake news?
I believe so. This is actually a fake site. I found it on Spokes, but it's one of those. Yes. Well, what was that? Drunk school principal defecates in front of students during Pledge of Allegiance.
Yes, that was the one that caught my eye.
I think they are. I think this is like a fake news site that I found it on. I mean, I found it as a thing, first of all, in stats of most shared fake news. I then searched the individual thing to find the sites. Then I found that one that disproves it, and then it sent me to this. And it's obviously a fake news site where they just create funny stuff. But that's the thing. Someone just shares it, and then it just goes everywhere. I mean, for instance, I saw Facebook the other week, a member of my family shared a post on Facebook, and it said, I was in Aldi, which is a supermarket in England. I was in Aldi the other day, and I saw that some old woman had dropped a photo on the floor out of her wallet. And I picked it up, but she'd gone. So if anyone knows who this belongs to, could you please get in touch with me? Because this is an old photo from the 50s, and it really must mean something to this person. Right. So obviously it's a very nice thing. Okay. Then underneath the picture is a picture of Marty McFly's mum and dad from Back to the Future. So like someone's sharing it, and it's like, and it all like got this really nice story to it. And then a picture of Marty McFly's. It's like one of those kind of things, isn't it?
Yeah. And that example is actually really, really good, because it astonishes me the extent to which people believe things that they see on social media and the internet generally, and the ease with which this stuff can be disseminated doesn't seem to have led to any increase in skepticism about what people are actually reading. I know plenty of people who will just accept things that they read online as being true because they equate it with traditional media, with all of its checks and balances and all of that kind of stuff. And the fact that all of the mechanisms to try and ensure that a story is true, which applies to traditional print media, doesn't apply to the internet, doesn't seem to impact on a lot of people's assessments of the credibility of what they're reading.
Yeah, like you can just upload a picture of RoboCop and put above it, this man was badly hurt in the line of duty and now has all these prosthetics, like equals one prayer.
Yeah, exactly. I think you could probably start a GoFundMe page to get RoboCop more prosthetics. And I reckon you would easily get $1,000.
I think we should try it. To be fair, if you get RoboCop's prosthetics for £1,000, I'm up for that.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. I'd be well up for that. I do slightly like RoboCop, but it's one of those films. I watched it when I was very, very young. My brother used to watch it. So I was about sort of 6 or 7, I think, when I watched RoboCop, which is a little bit too young on reflection for that, because it can be quite a gory film.
It is, yes. It's a violent film. I watched it probably around about the same age, though. It's one of those ones on TV. We had 5 channels and a TV in your bedroom. You just stuck it on. If it was on Channel 5 on a night, then you just watched it. I loved it. I loved the old RoboCop. And it hasn't aged too badly. There's only one bit that's aged terribly, and that is the Ed 209, which is the big robot created, like, as the anti-RoboCop, which just is like stop motion and looks pretty terrible. But apart from that, the rest of the film, everything holds up really well. It's a really cool film. I bought like the director's cut last year on Blu-ray.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because, I wouldn't be against watching that again, actually. My brother used to do an impression of Ed 209, where he would sort of like stomp around the living room. And then instead of shooting, he would kind of jab me repeatedly under the ribs with his first 2 fingers. And he would pretend to be killing me with a machine gun, just like Ed 209.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, like, oh, you did this great impression. He'd just sort of stomp around the living room, occasionally killing businessmen. But...
Yeah, he was really method. So he would just kind of bring in a load of businessmen and just mow them down for me.
Yeah, it was good times.
Yeah, good times.
So we will end today's episode there. I'd just like a quick shout out to our super fan, Andrea Thomas, who listens to us every week. At least I hope she does now, and that she hasn't stopped last week, and now she finally gets a shout out and misses it because she's finally given up on us. But yes, I'd like to thank you for tuning in every week, and thank you for being a spokesperson for our podcast. Do you have anything to say before we leave, Mike?
Yes, obviously this podcast is a precursor to the world government that will one day be headed by Dean and I. Obviously, we are just collecting fans at the moment. So Andrea will have a role in the international cabinet in due course. And if you, dear listener, also become a super fan, then you can have a role in our international cabinet and you will not be shot against a wall.
Yes. Look out for the upcoming Patreon that we set up, in which we can set out our roles. There'll be a certain price bracket for each one.
It's not going to be cheap, but it's definitely going to be worth it.
But it'll be worth it because, you know, owning small countries is always a plus for just a short price of helping us out.
Exactly. Somebody's got to run Djibouti. It's not going to run itself.
Yep. Maya Djibouti just doesn't give up. All right. Okay. Well, we'll leave that there. So thanks, everybody, and I hope you tune in next week for another exciting episode of Holding Court.
Goodbye, everybody, and especially Andrea.
If you know of any strange court or legal cases you would like us to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at holding.court@outlook.com.